You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Welcome back to EW's Game of Thrones weekly podcast. This is bonus episode 4 of 4, the finale, if you will, of talking about my book, Fire Cannot Kill a Dragon, the untold story of making Game of Thrones. I'm James Hibbard, and as always, I'm here with my podcast partner, Darren Franich. And now we're kind of moving into the home stretch here of the Thrones Odyssey.
Yes, the home stretch, the famously uncontroversial final seasons of Game of Thrones. James, I'm not sure how you found any material at all in covering that part of the show in your book, because obviously there's very little to talk about. No, James, as I've said before in this very special limited series, my enjoyment of your book really only accelerated as we got closer and closer to the end of the series, because, you know, as much as in the early parts of Fire Cannot Kill a Dragon, I felt like you had so many great revelations about what went into the development of the show, what the kind of mood was in making the show in those early days when it was decidedly not the biggest show in the world. Everything really does change in your book, and indeed in the world as it experienced Game of Thrones, when you get to the last couple of seasons. We talked a lot about the final season and the finale last season, disagreed about some things, no shortage of opinion about the finale and about some choices that they made. I'd be curious to know, just for yourself, again, my perception of you covering Game of Thrones was you finished covering the finale, you walked away in slow motion while everything exploded behind you, but in fact you were just walking into the next exploding car. This metaphor is falling apart all around me to write this book. What was it like sort of circling around and talking to some of the people involved in Game of Thrones after the finale, in the kind of wake of, you know, this huge pop culture moment that everybody on earth had an opinion about?
I mean, most of them were actually pretty open to having opinions. Some had very strong opinions. You know, one producer just went right for it and said, you know, season 8 has you know, the best content we've ever made. And other ones were more circumspect. And everyone sort of had their own take. The showrunners were great about getting specific about why they made certain decisions in the final season. So they're really good about sort of detailing, you know, why Bran, why Bran should be king, why Dany had her dark turn, you know, why different endings were the right endings. In terms of the finale criticism, they talked about that much less, because, you know, and it's for a couple of reasons that they detail, that they speak to in the book, and I'll kind of extrapolate a bit further here. One of them is that they can't criticize anything without criticizing either other people who were part of the process or, you know, kind of damaging HBO. And HBO was this great content partner that basically gave them everything they wanted and needed. So even if they criticize their own writing, they're essentially criticizing HBO's, you know, product that they've left behind. That's, you know, presumably going to make, you know, lots of, you know, money and esteem for HBO for many years on. And second of all, you know, anything they criticize, you know, feelings about things change, opinions change. You know, they sort of very much think about the ending of The Sopranos and how divisive that was, and then it became more liked and accepted as time goes on. They know new people are going to discover the show and watch it, you know, without the same level of hype and expectation that went into the final season. So just strategically, it's not a very good idea to kind of validate any particular criticism when, like, 10 years from now, people won't even necessarily think about a specific thing. Or maybe they will. And the opinions that are out there now are pretty much, you know, what they're going to be. But you know, so for both those reasons, sort of strategically, they're reluctant to criticize. And I think that this comes across to some as arrogance sometimes, when it's really more like, no, we rather people criticize us than do anything that hurts anybody else. You know, just in the name of looking more humble. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, they have criticisms about their own work. There are things that are so specific that none of us watching would ever even think of.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, to be clear, I'm someone, as a TV critic, I'm literally paid to, like, say my dumb opinions all day. I've always thought that the best approach to something like this was the David Chase approach after finishing Sopranos, which was to essentially never say anything about it, like, until maybe the press tour for his Sopranos prequel, which is maybe another story. But, you know, I even so, James, I would just say that for those people out there listening to this who've not already read your book, I did feel like there was a lot of insight offered into, you know, broader thoughts on the final season, broader thoughts on the finale. You know, the idea that is kind of mentioned, that is kind of Bran being the right ruler or the right person in the end. You know, to me, that was interesting insight to get from the creative minds involved in the show, because it was just kind of like a moment where I realized, oh, like, that was part of their instinct. And to me, one thing that I like about the entire saga, A Song of Ice and Fire, is the idea that the right people never wind up in charge. And so it was interesting that, you know, in their approach to it, they were kind of seeing the satisfaction index in one direction. And, you know, on some level, I think, and I'm intrigued to see if this is, you know, explored in the upcoming George R. R. Martin books, or to what extent, you know, those books will pay off anything. You know, it does seem as if the notion of anticlimax was not a part of the final season, that it was really meant to be big, huge, involve all the characters. That comes across most of all, of course, in the section of your book where you cover The Long Night. You've already covered The Long Night episode hugely in depth when it aired. And even so, I kind of thought that returning to that in your book was so interesting, because that's an episode that I do not like. And I think I think they just fundamentally made a hugely wrong creative decision in terms of how they chose to light it, how they chose to tell the story. Yeah. Even so, I'm always so struck in your coverage of that episode, James, because that is one of the most intense production processes. I mean, setting aside an episode of television, I don't think there's any comparison, but that's one of the most intense production processes in terms of battlefield action, epic storytelling in history, I think. I mean, you know, this is something that you mentioned this last year, but the point-to-point comparison is kind of the Helm's Deep stuff in Lord of the Rings, and that's cross-cut with a lot of other things for a much shorter span of time. Like, so I don't know, like, it was, I've been intrigued to know, you know, stuff like that kind of 1 year out. It must be kind of interesting, you know, to kind of look back on that, or interesting to kind of see how people react to that stuff now.
Yeah, it's the Long Night was brutal. You know, people think, you know, Martin's delay with the books and the show's struggle to pull off the final two seasons as being like two separate issues. The point I kind of make in the book is that they're kind of the same issue. You know, they're both kind of, you know, trying to pull off a very tricky final third of an epic story with so many characters and storylines, and doing it in different mediums. And just as the books kept getting bigger and bigger, the show, you know, in terms of characters and storylines, the show kept getting bigger and bigger in terms of its scale, in terms of its production, until that final season, they were literally bumping up against the ceiling of what was physically possible. What they put into that season and what that they put into that episode, you know, like it or not, was just incredibly grueling and difficult. And, you know, they're out there, they were hit by two like back-to-back polar vortex storms with sub-freezing temperatures. And they're out there every single night to the early hours in the morning. And, you know, for weeks and months at a time, you know, doing this, and they're cold and they're freezing and they're doing the same action beats over and over again. And, you know, as people point out, if it wasn't the final season, people would have quit. That, that there would have been a mutiny halfway through the night shoots had everybody not known this is like for the grand action climax of the show, and we have to get it right. People really were at their breaking point. In terms of the lighting, there is one really good quote that I love. It's basically a quote of a quote, really. It's Brian Cogman. He's talking about The Lord of the Rings and a famous anecdote where somebody asked the director of photography, where does all the light come from during one of the scenes in Shelob's lair? And he said, the same place as the music. And Brian Cogman points out, it's a perfectly valid answer, but in Thrones, they do source lighting, which means lighting that is always from a realistic source of illumination, whether it's moonlight or torches or sunlight. It's not that they don't have lights in the set, but the lighting kind of replicates what you would get in real life in that scene. So in Game of Thrones, if you shoot a battle at night, this is how you light it. And this is how they've lit so many dark scenes in the show previously. What was unique is having that many dark scenes back to back in an episode that was so hugely anticipated. So it wasn't that they necessarily did anything they haven't done before, or it wasn't necessarily that they broke format. But what they did is they stacked so many of those scenes together. And then you combine that with technical issues like video compression when you have a bunch of people watching something at one time, and TV set calibration and all these other things. And you end up with a viewing experience that a lot of people couldn't enjoy, which of course is never the goal.
Yeah. And I mean, listen, the human eye perceives light differently from the way the cameras do. So all this talk about filming something realistically, like there is no such thing as realism because cameras are technological things. You have to kind of work within the constrictions of the technology to create something people can actually see. Not going to dwell on that. I do think that in a larger sense, what's interesting about The Long Night is that more than almost anything else in the show, you could maybe argue for Battle of the Bastards being another example, is truly a we are at an apex fantasy moment here. There is a one obvious bad guy who needs to be taken down, and everyone else is a good guy. And I've always wondered if that also played a little bit into the sense of the final season as being different from what had come before, that there were this was a show that had gone from having like a five ring circus of different organizations, each some bad and some good, to that kind of sense of the overall schism between who we're rooting for, who we're rooting against. But that kind of leads into the second half of the final season, where you think you're rooting against one queen and you find out that you are kind of also rooting against another queen. Daenerys Targaryen, her big character turn. James, of all of the, I don't want to say controversies, but of all the kind of big topics that are covered in depth in a really cool way in your book, I do think you approach her turn in the penultimate episode in kind of the most intensive, panoramic, let's try to get all sides of this issue kind of way. We've talked about that. It's something that I think is still really at the core of a certain corner of the fandom's concerns about the final season. But I'd love to know in talking to Emilia Clarke and talking to the people who were really closely involved in that storyline, what was that kind of post-mortem like on this character who had been so central to the show as a heroic figure who then became Death Destroyer of Worlds in the last couple of episodes?
Yeah. I mean, one tidbit from the book that I particularly liked was how the writers expected the season 7 scene where Daenerys executed the Tarleys to be really disturbing and be this clear sign that she was on the wrong path.
Your Grace, nothing scrubs bold notions from a man's head like a few weeks in a dark cell.
I meant what I said. I'm not here to put men in chains. If that becomes an option, many will take it. I gave them a choice. They made it.
But then one of them went to a viewing party and was shocked when everybody was cheering So the audience had kind of been on Team Dragon Queen for so long that they didn't really question what she did like the writers intended her to. So now you can read that as a show failed to make her arc more clear. And I think most people, you know, feel that the arc wasn't made clear or wasn't, you know, they didn't take put enough beats in there to kind of earn that turn. But to me, it also says something about the way we follow leaders. I mean, this year has shown us many examples of people kind of blindly supporting their preferred teams and not really questioning them, even when they do things that are clearly wrong.
Yeah, I mean, this is a much larger topic that, as you've just indicated, has a lot of real world layers to it that we are not necessarily super able to cover in depth on this TV centric podcast. But I do feel like the kind of teamification of fandom in general, and specifically as relates to Game of Thrones, you know, there is that great moment in the finale when it's probably the one part of the finale that I like, because it's the one part where people talk about politics. Ooh, like, that'll really get the people excited. When Sam suggests, why don't we become a democracy, and everyone laughs at that.
We represent all the great houses, but whomever we choose, they won't just rule over lords and ladies. Maybe the decision about what's best for everyone should be left to, well, everyone.
Maybe we should give the dogs a vote as well.
I'll ask my horse.
As a viewer in the present day, your response to that should kind of be like, oh, right, I hate all these people. Like, I mean, you know, like we're allowed to feel good things about characters who otherwise represent things that we don't like. But I think about that moment a lot as maybe one other, you know, very explicit wink on the part of the storytellers, but, you know, nevertheless an indication that, like, yeah, like, it's all well and good to worship in a kind of culturally appropriate fan mm-hmm. way these characters, but also remember that, like, you know, democracy is pretty cool, and they would disagree with that assessment.
Yeah. I mean, which brings up Bran again, which another point I made, you know. And I try not to do much pontificating of my own in the book. I try to leave it to all the insiders to make their points. But one point that I made was that I think a lot of people focused on the Iron Throne as this prize to be won. And that makes sense because many of the characters were focused on it as a prize to be won. And even HBO's marketing kind of, you know, played into the idea of who will end up on the Iron Throne. And made it seem like a prize to be won. But in George R. R. Martin's books and also in the show, you know, power, especially that level of power, is supposed to be a burden and one that tends to either draw people who are corruptible or eventually corrupt people who are on it. And in that way, the Iron Throne is really like the One Ring in Lord of the Rings. They're both these sort of quest items that are actually corruptive and that cannot be wielded. And both of them also end up with the same fate. Both of them end up being destroyed by the fire in which they were made, in terms of the One Ring back to Mount Doom, and in terms of the Iron Throne back to Dragonfire.
You know, it's just funny, James, because when you made that point in the book, it really got me thinking a lot more about how incredibly key the performance of Mark Addy as King Robert Baratheon is in the first season.
Yes.
Because in a way, he is meant to be like the Gollum figure in that kind of equation, that, like, here is someone who, when he got on the Iron Throne, you were kind of meant to understand he was essentially this, like, shining young King Arthur figure, you know, rescuing the country. And now he's just gone so totally to seed. It's something that, you know, again, thinking about ways that the storytelling prepares you for incredible darkness, you know, you as a viewer are maybe expected to think, like, oh yeah, like, that's not a good thing for anyone to sit on there necessarily.
Yeah.
Time to elect a parliament. some great stuff in the book just on, you know, different people's kind of perspectives with regards to Daenerys and how that kind of plays into the finale. I especially thought that Peter Dinklage, in your interview with him, he had a lot of kind of interesting thoughts about, you know, some of the broader things going into what would lead someone to turn in that direction. Let's hear what he had to say.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, but that's what I love about this show, because we love Daenerys. All the fans out there love Daenerys, and she's doing these things mm-hmm. for the greater good.
Yeah.
The purification of this place, you know, it's freeing everyone for the greater good. You're going to hurt some innocents along the way,
right?
Unfortunately. It's what war is. Dave and Dan and I were talking about, as these seasons are going along, it's these decisions made in war, like Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Mm.
Horrible. And then the idea of, like, did we make the right choice in terms of that? Choices in war. Choices you make in war. How much further would the war have gone on if America didn't make that horrible decision?
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Dear Colgate, I love that you love that I love being at home. You even let me whiten my teeth from home. Because you know how I feel about getting up from my cloud couch. The Colgate Optic White LED Kit gives professional level results in just 10 minutes a day for 10 days when used as directed. And that's why, Colgate, I want you to meet my parents. Because ever since meeting you, I've been living life to the brightest. Colgate Optic White. Find it at all major retailers.
We're back with EW's Game of Thrones Weekly. You know, it's funny, reading the final chapters of your book, you know, there's a great kind of synthesis of things happening, because as we are kind of reading these final moments for different characters in the show, and of course the finale has, you know, little endings for each of the characters who we followed all along. In Fire Cannot Kill a Dragon, we're also kind of getting these great final thoughts from many of the actors and many of the people involved in making the show, for whom it had been, you know, for some of them, a decade-long process. You know, I'd be especially intrigued to know, in talking to some of the younger people who'd been, like, kids when they started making the show, it must be so interesting speaking to them as people who have literally kind of grown up all in the midst of Game of Thrones. I especially like that Maisie Williams, I get the vibe that she's ready to, like, go and live in, like, a house by the coast for a while and, like, say goodbye to culture for a little while, which I kind of understand. But what was that like, kind of speaking to some of the people who had been at the center of this and had literally sort of only known this Game of Thrones experience as they moved through childhood into adulthood?
Yeah, I mean, it's not like, I mean, if you think about working a job for years and years and what it's like to leave that and how difficult it is and how many bonds there, I mean, just imagine if you'd grown up on that set. I mean, it becomes more than a workplace. It becomes a second home and a second family. And I think that's one reason that, you know, that cast is so tight. You know, there's a lot of cast ensemble shows where there's lots of infighting and drama and people snarking at each other, especially after a show ends. But, you know, even now, a year later, you know, it's hard to find somebody on that show to say something negative about the show. And for the younger actors, there's a lot of insecurity in terms of going out into the world, because, you know, if you're somebody like Charles Dance, or, you know, one of the sort of veteran actors in the show, you know, you've had a career before, then you had Thrones, so they expect to have a career after. But if all you've been on is Thrones, you know, they don't know if they're going to be pigeonholed as that. They don't know if they're going to be getting other work or not. And you know, and even ones who had other work when the show was on the air, it's like, yes, but that was during the off season. I always knew I had Thrones to come back to. I don't know if I'm going to have something to come back to. You know, again, certainly not anything I'm going to like as much as this anymore.
Yeah, it was funny just, like, thinking about how with some of them, they've been getting to the point where it was like, shoot Game of Thrones, go make an X-Men movie, or shoot Game of Thrones and, you know, go do another production. It's such an interesting experience to think about And seems pretty unique to me. Again, this kind of goes back to something we were saying in an earlier podcast, but I do think that, you know, whatever else you feel about the showrunners and their decisions in the later half of the show, there is some of that kind of, you know, Harry Potter movie casting kismet involved. If you cast people who are really good at playing those characters when they are very, very young and still good at playing those characters when they are totally different people, you know, 7 or 8 years later. Another thing I really liked in your book, you know, Brienne of Tarth is a character who I think that in some ways people worry, you know, great stuff with her earlier in the show. Also a character who didn't always seem super well serviced by the final season, but definitely someone who has this kind of larger iconography. And I thought that Gwendolyn Christie, who's always such an awesome person to hear from, she had some really interesting thoughts about the legacy of Brienne in the kind of aftermath of Game of Thrones. Let's hear what she had to say.
What I loved is that her, in the last scene, she's at work. And I love that her last line is, "I think ships take precedence over brothels." That's what I wanted to be remembered for. And that's how I like her being remembered, is a feminist icon and a practical woman.
Yeah, and I love that reflection of her on her character. She's so proud of that character and put so much of her own strength into that character, and she was, you know, just very happy where her character ended up there, which seemed pretty perfect there.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that in your book, James, you kind of go really in depth about the decision to end Game of Thrones and what went into that. You know, what went into, as we've discussed previously, you know, seemingly cutting it off without expanding the world as much as the books had. There is always going to be a part of me that wonders what would that last season have looked like had there been, you know, this sort of finale, this big epic showdown, King's Landing destroyed. And then, similar to the Lord of the Rings books, if you'd had like a really protracted denouement where you kind of come to see like how, you know, all these things that happen don't necessarily just come to a screeching halt. You know, I suspect on some level I may get that from A Dream of Spring when that comes out at some far point in the future. But it is just interesting to think of, you know, Game of Thrones started as a show which largely had to work within the restrictions of, you know, we cannot show things. If there's a battle, someone has to get knocked out. We need to fill a lot of time on these sets with actors who we have because we're running low on, you know, actual running time. And then in the end, it kind of became a show that could really do these huge, big budget moments in a way that, you know, moved the goalposts for a lot of other shows. I you know, it seems as if there are a lot more shows that are going to try to be like Game of Thrones in that way, in that kind of big, huge battle epic quality, without the early seasons of kind of being able to experiment a little bit. And I get kind of bummed out about that. I mean, it's funny, when we finished talking about Game of Thrones, the series, I believe the first prequel was still in production, and then that didn't go through for all kinds of reasons, probably because these shows are really, really hard to make. But, you know, it's interesting that, you know, HBO, which is trying so hard to continue Game of Thrones, and there is another continuation series on the horizon. I guess I'm wondering, James, do you think there will be another Game of Thrones level event in television ever again?
Yes. It probably won't have dragons in it. But yes, I think there eventually will be. The question is whether it'll be as big of a communal viewing experience as this one, because this was really in the last days of linear TV, right?
Yeah.
You know, as the streaming era, you know, began to really take over. So one of the great things about Thrones was that sort of feeling of every Sunday night, like everyone stopped and watched it, and then everybody talked about it the next day, you know, the whole cliche of water cooler show. And also, you know, the question of whether we'll ever have a franchise show this big that is allowed to do what the show did, which is end. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people feel that the show ended too early. When the showrunners made that decision, you know, the big fear, the big trap was staying on the air too long. You know, nobody had ever accused a show of intentionally ending too soon because there's all these market forces on anything successful to keep going. And so, you know, it's really tough to imagine in today's marketplace now, any show or any franchise being able to really go out at its peak again. Like, you can't imagine a Marvel writer saying, you know, I feel like this should be the last one. And Disney going, yeah, okay, sure. Or, you know, or even, you know, now HBO. I mean, AT&T has now purchased HBO. Do you think AT&T would let Game of Thrones end if it was on the air right now when it has their 7% annual dividend to like take care of?
That's the thing. I mean, you know, one thing that in a way your book is really this extraordinary document of just how much television itself and the cultural appreciation and expectations of television were changing while Game of Thrones was on, to a certain extent because of things that Game of Thrones was doing. I remember at some point in season 6 or season 7, it had been a kind of somewhat dire summer for big blockbuster movies. Mm-hmm. And I recall just talking to some colleagues once and us realizing, you know, the issue, the reason why these movies are failing is that for a significant proportion of people who like seeing big fantastical things, their movie of the week now is Game of Thrones. And you know, it's the best of both worlds. You know, it's able to do these huge things while also kind of, you know, dangling in front of you is continuation happening next week. It's just such a radical shift. I also remember there was one season, this is me butchering all these facts, so I apologize. But I distinctly recall one season of Game of Thrones when it debuted. That was like the year that suddenly HBO Go, like everyone was using all their parents' passwords all the time to watch Thrones.
Yeah.
And it was such another moment of realizing, okay, like, you know, For a certain demographic, especially for younger people, watching this on HBO, on television, is no longer even like the basis for how you experience this. It is entirely on this kind of streaming service. And as you said, you know, Thrones as a transitional show, you feel like now we're in the aftermath of that. And I wonder how a show like that would even manage. You do mention in your book the cross comparison of the other genre series that was hugely successful while Game of Thrones was on, The Walking Dead. And I was just so struck because while reading your book, there was the announcement about how, you know, AMC is quadrupling down on The Walking Dead.
You know, thank God Dalton Ross, the great Dalton Ross, our colleague, is the one who covers Walking Dead, because I love to beat up so much on that show and how it's been, you know, run into the ground by AMC, just kind of relentlessly run into the ground. And like in that announcement, that in terms of, you know, the spinoff they're doing, they announced they're doing a spinoff with Daryl and Carol. And that is how little that AMC gives a shit about the viewing experience. They announce Walking Dead is going to end. So there's a bunch of suspense about what's going to happen. And then they just ruin that suspense by telling you who's going to survive,
right,
and move on to the spinoff.
Well, it's such a strange, you know, we're not going to go too far down this rabbit hole, but it does connect back to what I think is very interesting about Game of Thrones, because, you know, the nature of that announcement almost seems like a way to assure viewers, like, hey, like, yes, we are ending, so get excited for that ending, but also, you know, the two kind of longest running characters will continue on. And, you know, I think the Walking Dead thing is its own business case study. You know, it has way less viewers now than it used to have, but I think there is a sense that there is this core viewership that will now follow it anywhere. The fact that Talking Dead still sometimes gets a million viewers is probably evidence enough that AMC can still print money off of that. But, you know, I do think that it's just really interesting to think of the final season of Game of Thrones, a season that I definitely had, you know, major issues with, was this 6-episode split over 6 weeks. The intention was that every episode was going to be a 5-course meal. I don't know. I find that to be admirable in a way. And I guess I'm saying that I miss it, James. I didn't like it, but I also miss it, is my feeling about it. Am I part of the problem here?
I mean, my sort of grand Monday morning quarterbacking of the final season is if they had two more episodes and then they had split episodes 4, 5, and 6 into two episodes each. No, it's not even made any changes to them. But each of those episodes are like around like 70, 80 minutes anyway. So they're all like nearly the length of two episodes. And if you split them into two episodes, you A, get people to give time to digest the first half they watched and anticipate the second half the next week. So in a way, I feel like both halves would have been more like responded to better if they had done that. And if there was just two more episodes in general, in terms of the whole thing, in terms of content, to kind of flesh it out a bit. I feel like the whole thing probably would have landed better.
I like what you're saying, because I think that even then, you know, in speaking to someone like Natalie Emanuel, there's the recognition that like, oh, there's someone who had, you know, good narrative real estate in earlier seasons, who in the final season, the death of her character is meant to be a huge thing for Danny. But we as viewers at that point were kind of like, we haven't seen you guys talk in a while. I do wonder if, you know,
that was probably the most obvious scene that should have been in there.
Yeah. And it's just, you know, it goes back to, you know, when the show was really firing on all cylinders, there was this sense of like, it's not just an ensemble, it's an ensemble of ensembles, and you know, each twosome and trio kind of has their own unique quality to it. In kind of losing that quality in the last season, is there something you lose that you can't necessarily gain back with huge action scenes? All this and more, I think, James, you cover it really effectively in a way that certainly for me, you know, I was kind of at a point in my Thrones experience where I felt like, okay, the show is the show. I still Google every day to see if Martin has any news about Fire and Blood 2. And also Winds of Winter would also be good, but I'm not holding my breath. I just want more Fire and Blood now. That's all I ask for. But even so, I did think that there's a real graceful quality to, in reading Fire Cannot Kill a Dragon, I do think that it helped me kind of come to terms with the show's ending in a lot of really interesting ways. We are over a year out from it now. Feels like it's been 10 years, frankly. A lot of things have happened. In general, as you were speaking to some of the cast and creators, what were some of the final thoughts that you kind of really responded to, or some things people said about the larger nature of the show that you felt like really got to the core of the experience?
Yeah, there is a lot of really, the last chapter of the book has this just ensemble of sort of goodbye quotes, and there's a lot of really poignant ones in there. I actually do like one that Benioff said. He talked about this, you know, which, because it gives this sort of cinematic quality of the show ending. He talked about this moment after the final season wrapped, and they had a cast party, and then they all went back to his house in Northern Ireland, and it's like on the beach, and it was, you know, early in the morning, the sun was starting to rise, and there's these young actors, you know, now not so young, you know playfully like rolling down the hill, you know, almost surely like drunk out of their minds, you know, and he's sitting there and he's just thinking, you know, this was a really good job. And and I thought that was very sweet. I think my favorite goodbye was from Ian Glenn, who played Ser Jorah, who gave this really nice, well, hey, let's just go ahead and play it because we have it.
What we do is basically ephemeral. We move fairly swiftly as actors. We're quite, you know, we're very used to getting lost in something and then forgetting all about it and getting lost in something else, something that lived with you for a decade and was the best thing ever to be involved in and perceived as. That is pretty special, and I'll never, you know, till my dying day, of course, it will be, you know, the most exceptional acting experience. And the most amazing support, the most brilliant crew, where anything was possible, where there was great friendships and great deal of love for what we were doing and each other, and nothing will ever compare to it, and nothing will be like that ever.
nothing will ever be like that again, ever. And yeah, I love that quote because it kind of gives you a sense of the kind of aftershocks that they were going through after the show ended and had moved on to other jobs and kept on having these kind of waves of kind of loss over Missing Thrones, which I feel like a lot of people who were fans of the show had as well. So that was a really nice moment.
You know, James, what comes across most of all in the book, I think, is, you know, it's kind of a privilege to once again get to share in your experience of covering the show. You know, I've gotten to experience that as a reader of your stuff on EW.com, as a reader of the stuff you were doing for a magazine, and as someone who would just like slack you all the time with Game of Thrones related thoughts. But I do think that, you know, Fire Cannot Kill a Dragon, for me, it really stands as a monument to what it looks like when somebody does cover a project as in-depth as it can possibly be covered. Wealth of details, wealth of information, wealth of interviews with people who are all clearly able to speak really candidly and in a really in-depth way. These are all things I don't necessarily think are hugely in evidence in a lot of pop culture reporting now for all different kinds of reasons, just given the nature of how fast things kind of have to move. So it was just such a privilege to get to read Fire Cannot Kill a Dragon. When's the next book coming out, man? What's coming up next?
What am I, George R. R. Martin now? You're like already bugging me for the next book. You know, I'm done with book writing for a while. I'm really looking forward to just focusing on EW. And of course we have, House of the Dragon, the Game of Thrones, prequel coming out, George R. R. Martin's Winds of Winter coming out. We'll have some outtakes from the book, things that I had for the book that didn't end up in the book, and I'll be rolling those out on EW.com over the next coming months.
This is your kind of metaphorical Sir Pounce scenes that you're going to be releasing on EW.com.
Yeah. I think my favorite one was director Michelle McLaren. Talked about how she had to go out and meet wolves to film a scene with dire wolves. So she had to go like out to like this wolf farm in Michigan and be introduced and make friends with wolves. And it was this great sort of thing, but there wasn't really a place for it in the book. I didn't have anyone else for that particular moment. So there's a lot of things like that, little outtake orphans. That I'm looking forward to rolling out. But you know, I just want to thank like all the people that have listened to this podcast, all the people who've read the coverage, all the people who bought the book, or had something to say on social media or whatnot. It's been a real privilege to cover this show. There's a lot of hard work and also some a degree of luck in terms of getting in there at the right place at the right time. And the show has been, real incredible journey, as an entertainment reporter, it doesn't really get any better than covering something like this. Yeah. I'm just ending this really grateful and, hoping that, readers got, as much out of the coverage as I enjoyed sort of putting into it.
Well, this reader definitely got a lot out of it. And I know, James, we're all really grateful to you for your great coverage on the show. Fire Cannot Kill a Dragon, the untold story of making Game of Thrones. Not just the cherry on top of the sundae, but indeed a whole new sundae to enjoy as far as James Hibbard getting in under the hood of what made Game of Thrones tick. As James said, thank you everyone for listening to us, to this little extra special mini-series limited edition version of EW's Game of Thrones Weekly. Love to hear from you. Tweet at us. He's at James Hibbard. I'm at Darren Franich. Let us know what you think about the show. This is not by any means the end of the Game of Thrones experience as far as EW's coverage of it goes. We want to hear what you think. Give us a rating, give us a review wherever you get your podcasts. Fire Cannot Kill a Dragon, Game of Thrones, and the official untold story of the epic series is out now from Penguin Random House. Cannot recommend it enough. Available wherever you get your books. We're going to finish up this week with a clip from the audiobook narrated by Fred Sanders. And for now, James, once again, our watch has ended.
With no more words left to write, I ask that traditional final question. for when something popular and influential concludes. What is its legacy? It's probably not possible to sum up the contribution of Game of Thrones to the world. The series had such an enormous and varied impact on so many millions. But striving for the impossible was always the point. Brian Cogman, co-executive producer. The legacy of the show? It's too soon to tell. When you're writing an addendum chapter to this oral history for the 10th anniversary edition, then you can tell. David Benioff. It would be fun if it were like when you're watching Fast Times at Ridgemont High, where people are still watching it 20 years from now and going, "Look, that's a young Alfie Allen, and that's a young Sophie Turner." It would be really fun on a personal level to know we had a helping hand in launching those careers, and other actors who aren't so young, but we gave a boost. Dan Weiss. I hope people keep watching the show. I hope kids who are the age of our kids now grow up and watch the show and take from it what they take from it. Nobody owns the future of what they make. Once you put something out there, it's not yours anymore. It doesn't belong to the people watching it now either. In 20 years, there will be a whole new group of people, and they'll either watch it or they won't. If they do, the reaction might be very different from your reaction. So I hope they watch it, and I hope they like it.